Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Parenting is tough enough, but what if you are gay or lesbian parents? How are your challenges different? And how have others like you fared in this parenting episode? And what about your children? How are they coping and what are their experiences? On this edition of Line One, Your Health Connection, my guest is Clark University psychologist, Dr. Abby Goldberg. She's the author of two recent books that have looked at the evidence of what we know about lesbian and gay parents. And the first book is entitled Lesbian and Gay Parents and Their Children, and the most recent one, Gay Dads Transition to Adoptive Fatherhood. If you have questions or comments about the program today, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Our Anchorage number directly is 550-8433, 550-8433, toll free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Goldberg, it's a pleasure to meet you and talk with you before the program and have you as a guest. I appreciate your taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Let's start by just talking about parents or families in general. And how would we describe the typical American family now and perhaps characterize it as opposed to 25 or 50 years ago?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what we've seen past, 25, 35, 45, 50 years are, a great deal of changes to the point where perhaps there is really no kind of typical or normal American family to really speak of. So, there are more single-parent families today than 50 years ago. We see, as you mentioned, more lesbian and gay parents parenting. By extension, we really see fewer families headed by two heterosexual, married, biologically related to their children parents. So, and of course, a consequence of this is that we've seen, attitudes about families really changing and shifting to really be more inclusive of these different sort of family forms. So those are just some of them. There's others, too. We see more grandparents raising children, for example, more adoptive families and so on.
Are these changes that have had significant effects on children and the parents that we can, realistically measure and compare? Or are we stuck with, like we often are in medical issues, we know what's going on now, but we don't have good research from the past to make comparisons?
Well, there is some research showing that, for example, we know what matters for children's well-being. We know that, parents who are emotionally healthy, warm, supportive, consistent, that matters, right? So process, family process, what's going on in families matters actually more than the structure of families. So even more important, say, than how many parents there are, it matters sort of how parents are doing and how parents are parenting. So it's hard to say, for example, it's better to have two heterosexual parents without knowing what's going on in that family. Is it better to have two heterosexual parents who are arguing and who have financial difficulties and who have alcohol problems and mental health problems than a single parent who's got it together? So we can make some kind of comparisons because we know from when we compare different types of family structures that family process matters more than simply, the number of parents or what their gender is.
Mm-hmm. It seems that there's a gestalt, if I were to go out and design the right questionnaire, that our kids today are suffering more as a result of the changes in as what's happened to the American family, whatever that is, as you say, we don't know, than it was in the past. Is that true? Can we say that? Are our kids that kids are better off, that children are better adjusted, that families are working better today than they used to be, even though they may be much different than the traditional American family picture that we conjure up?
I don't know if we could say that. I mean, okay. I don't know if we could say they're better adjusted than in the past. I mean, part of it is it's very difficult to even know. You can measure or think about adjustment in so many different ways. There's academic adjustment, social adjustment, and emotional,
Right.
And then there's all these other things that are sort of impinge upon families that, you know, things that are, of course, changing, like the economy or technology, right? Social media.
Absolutely.
All these things have effects on families. And some are really positive, right?
Right.
And some are really maybe not positive. So it's so hard to know, you know, for example, could we compare children raised in the 1970s to now in terms of their self-esteem? You know, we might see certain things that we would consider positive, but we might also see some things that we would consider really negative. There's some study that came out a couple of years ago that showed that teens today are much more narcissistic than in the past,
right?
So we don't necessarily think that is a good outcome, but there may be other things that are related to that that are positive, right? Maybe teens today are more independent, right, which might correlate with narcissism. I don't know. I'm just sort of pointing that out.
It's
hard to just pick one index of sort of well-being. Mm-hmm.
So then let me ask you this, and let's expand just briefly then what you mean by process is better than structure in identifying how families work and what's good for a family, if I'm saying that appropriately. I'd like just to flesh that idea out a little bit better.
Sure. So again, it's very hard when you compare different types of families. Single parent families, grandparent headed families, adoptive parent families, two heterosexual biological parent families, gay parent families. What we see is that across what doesn't tend to matter is again, as much is the number of parents and the gender of parents and whether they're married, as much as the kinds of things that are happening in those families. So, again, what kinds of parenting qualities do those parents have? What kind of financial resources does that family have? How many transitions has that family been through in the past year, let's say, right? Has the family moved? Have they been out on the street? Have they become homeless? Like, these are things that are more important than simply whether somebody has a mother and a father or two mothers or two grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's somewhat similar to the idea that I heard as a pediatrician being trained 30 years ago that it's often quality rather than quantity as we got into the argument about women going back into the workplace.
Yes, it's very similar. And actually a corollary kind of argument is, you know, the whole argument around women working. Is it better for women to stay home or is it better to work? Well, it depends, right? It depends what they want to be doing. It depends on what kind of parenting is going on when they're with their children. The quality of the time with their children may matter a lot more than the quantity of time. So it is a very similar type of argument.
Let me remind listeners once again, my guest today is Dr. Abby Goldberg, and we're talking about the results of her research that have put together in a couple of books that she's recently published. First, Lesbian and Gay Parents and Their Children, and the second one is, I forgot the name, I got to move back here and find it again, Gay Dads Transition to Adoptive Fatherhood. So if you've got questions or comments about today's program, our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Well, another thing I think is important is we've kind of identified that your interest is in those factors that are affecting the outcome or how families are work together and their children is one of those factors may be the relationships and the sexual relationships, and particularly of the parents. So let's define some things as we get into this specific issue of gay and lesbian families and their offs and their children. So what is gay and lesbian, bisexual, heterosexual, transgender, heterosexism, those kind of things? Let's try to get them well defined as we get into this.
So gay and lesbian, you know, typically people use those terms to refer to people who are, you know, exclusively or primarily attracted to or form relationships with people of the same sex. But what's important there is that there's a lot of different dimensions of sexual orientation. There's attraction, there's who you form relationships with, and then there's your identification. So you don't call somebody gay unless they call themselves gay, right? They might have relationships with men, and they may be a man, but if they don't identify as gay, then you shouldn't call them gay. So that's a self-identification. Bisexual refers to people, men or women, who are attracted to or form relationships with people of both sexes, and again, who identify that way. And trans or transgender is a term that is increasingly being used more flexibly and all-encompassing than simply somebody who was born, say, biologically male, but their gender identity is female. Now it's really being used as more of a broad kind of umbrella term to capture the identities of people who just don't feel like they really fit into the kind of gender binary. They may not identify as male or female, but they might identify as genderqueer, gender variant, just having a more complex gender identity. And you mentioned heterosexism. That's just sort of the more institutionalized kind of devaluation of non-heterosexuality, right? We see it institutionalized in laws, policies, anything that sort of regards heterosexuality as the norm or as the right way to be.
When you start off to researching these issues and looking at all the literature, all the studies that have been done and analyzing them and putting them together in a very excellently, fairly easy to read book that's available for the public and those who have interest in this to read, there's a lot of issues that must make this kind of difficult. I think of them as, in a scientific sense, as confounding variables, things that make it difficult. What are some of the problems that jump out at you and that maybe listeners would want to know about that make it difficult to make this kind of evaluation or these kind of studies?
So you mean in terms of how to synthesize all this stuff?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are issues with the studies that have been done. I don't know if that's sort of what you're referring to, but the research has primarily been done on fairly well-educated, mostly white samples. So it's hard in putting all this together to really make generalizations to groups that fall outside of that, which, of course, is quite a lot of people. There's also a lot less research on gay men. So in my analysis and review of hundreds of studies, what jumped out at me sort of immediately is that there's a lot more research on lesbians, particularly lesbian parents. Part of that just reflects the fact that there are more lesbian parents, but there's other reasons for that as well. So I guess there's just a lot of limitations with the research that we have so far, and that's not bad, and it's not unexpected because it's a new research area. So I wanted to provide sort of the most up-to-date, concise synthesis of all of the research while recognizing that there are certain limitations of that research.
And that's not bad. There's always going to be some problems. You can't do the perfect study. And what you do is you recognize those, and it's discussed in the book, the book I read, which was the Lesbian and Gay Parents and Their Children. You go into some of these issues that make it more difficult to draw conclusions, and these factors that make it difficult. And part of it was getting into being very precise about terms, as I was trying to do a minute ago. What are the misconceptions that many people in America have now about gays and lesbians that must have also, it would seem to me, be kind of confounding? I mean, even researchers may take in some of these misconceptions or biases into their studies.
Well, I guess a lot of the misconceptions stem from this perception that, heterosexuality is the norm. And so if you start with that perspective that, being heterosexual is normal, then you're going to see gay men and lesbians as not normal. And so you're asking people to measure up to some kind of artificially created standard Which they obviously can't, because by definition they're not heterosexual. So I think some of the stereotypes are that being gay is a choice, and that it's cruel to children, and then why would you want to bring children into this relationship when it's unfair, and your kids will be teased because you're gay. Other stereotypes of gay men and lesbians more generally are that they're selfish, they don't want to have children, that they will not be good or caring parents. That's particularly a stereotype about gay men, that gay men in particular are pedophiles. All of these stereotypes are not substantiated by research. For example, we know that from national representative data sets that over 50% of gay men and lesbians want to become parents. We also know that gay men are no more likely to sexually abuse children than they're actually less likely than heterosexual men to sexually abuse children. So there's a lot of data to sort of invalidate these stereotypes. There's also stereotypes that lesbians and gay men's relationships don't last, that they just have these short-term, non-monogamous relationships, that they're hypersexual. Again, these are stereotypes that just don't hold up to research. Mm-hmm.
Where do these ideas originate? How do we, as a culture, come to these misunderstandings?
Again, I think it goes back to kind of this valorization of heterosexuality, that we've long regarded that as the norm, and that there have been stereotypes of gay men and lesbians as mentally ill. I mean, homosexuality was in the DSM, right, until the early 1970s. Right. And there wasn't a lot of research until, the mid-1900s on sexual minorities. And so these stereotypes really were free to kind of breed, I guess you could say, in people's minds. And, there weren't a lot of sexual minorities in positions of power. Just you could sort of say the same thing around stereotypes of women and men being in power. So, a lot has changed in the last 30 to 50 years in terms of starting to study sexual minorities in their own right, and B, sort of finding through that research that, these types of stereotypes just do not hold up.
Mm-hmm. I am, I have a problem. I have a desire for people to understand the power of science. And what I see science is a method of looking at how things really, really work. And, you think science has been around a long time, but it's actually not. I mean, even control studies are 50 or 60 years old. I mean, they really are getting going. And it seems to me, and I don't want to overstate this, but as what's happening in this arena of looking at lesbians and gay parents and their children, that we have finally begun to look at what we really know and not just ideas or superstitions or things that we were told, and getting some facts about what's really going on that is helping us begin to understand not only sexual preferences, but, I mean, things like, the differences between poor people and rich people as far as how they do and how they're in that situation, and the mentally ill and minority groups and so forth. Is that an overstatement, or do you see some of what's going on as just an inevitable consequence of us beginning to really ask the right questions and look at the evidence?
So your question is, whether I'm a little confused.
It's a big editorial comment. I'm just wondering how important is science and beginning to really look at the evidence about certain things is helping us come out of these cultural biases and misunderstandings?
Yeah, no, I think science is huge. I mean, a big reason, and I discuss this in the book, for the initial studies of lesbian and gay parenting was, there were kids who were being taken away from their lesbian mothers in court. And so there was a really an awareness that we need research to show that these lesbian mothers are not mentally ill, that they're not going to harm their children as their parents. There were well publicized cases of kids getting taken away from lesbian mothers and giving to their fathers who had just gotten out of prison for murder. I mean, there were some really sort of astonishing cases. So with the advent of research on gay parenting, that played a huge role in court cases and how educated lawyers were, and it made it harder to sort of just rely on stereotype in making these kinds of custody decisions. And people began to look, particularly lawyers, to the science, to the research, to make these kinds of decisions. And, of course, we've continued to see this with the recent marriage equality cases, right? People are looking to the research to make decisions about marriage and marriage equality. So I do think it has played a significant role. We've also seen that the media has increasingly covered this research. So mm-hmm. It's sort of this interesting, it's not just that the science exists, it's that it now, really, in the last 5 to 10 years, is starting to be something that is just picked up on. And the number of requests that I have from reporters and people who want to do stories about this, is really kind of increased, I think, particularly in the last few years.
The other thing the media has done, particularly I'm thinking about television media maybe more, is that what we see on TV as families has changed considerably. Is there reasonably reliable evidence that what we see on TV impacts on what we accept as normal?
Yeah, there's some great research showing that, the media, so the visibility of gay parenthood and really does change people's ideas about what is normal, if that's kind of what you're referring mm-hmm. to. And mm-hmm. people sort of see, oh, okay, there's gay characters on TV, and they're not so scary, and they seem pretty quote unquote normal, and all that has an effect on people's kind of, I think, a level of acceptance. Now, some people have also critiqued the kinds of gay characters that appear on TV shows as being kind of stereotyped or stereotypical.
Sure.
But I guess then, others mm-hmm. that come back at it and say, well, at least there's visibility. At least there are gay characters. At least there's even some gay parent, mm-hmm. characters on TV. So it definitely raises the awareness, the visibility, and probably to some degree the acceptance, although there's, of course, plenty of people watching those shows who are pretty steadfast in their beliefs and probably will not be, mm-hmm. those beliefs will not be changed by a TV show.
Right, right. All right. Let me remind the listeners once again, if you've got questions or comments about today's program, you can reach us at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1. And remember, you have to spell that out, LINEONE, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. My guest today is Dr. Abby Goldberg. She is a clinical psychologist at Clark University and has recently researched some issues about lesbian and gay parents and their children and gay men as parents. And if you've got questions or comments, please don't hesitate to give us a call or send us an email. How many families, what do we know specifically about gay and lesbian parents as a percentage of our overall parenting family group?
Yeah, it's very hard to actually estimate the number of gay couples, gay parents. We see estimates ranging from 300,000 to 10 million, which, of course, is a giant stretch, a giant range. The big problem with getting any kind of accurate survey data, for example, on the number of lesbian and gay parents, is that first of all, many national surveys don't even ask about sexual orientation, right? They don't ask about sexual orientation or even the gender of parents. A lot of gay people don't want to self-disclose or self-identify as gay or lesbian on these kinds of surveys. So there's all kinds of issues with getting an accurate number or an accurate read on the number of gay and lesbian parents. And then, of course, any questions, any surveys that do ask about sexual orientation, you may find out the number of, say, 2, two, you know, lesbian two-parent families, but you don't know about all the single lesbian parents out there.
How about the acceptance of gays and lesbians? I would think that that is becoming more commonplace in the United States, and I know that there are some statistics that you quote in your in the book Lesbian and Gay Parents and Your Children. Can we share some of that information?
Oh yeah, yeah. Do you have it, or do you want me to?
Yeah, I've got it. In particularly that a 2008 Gallup poll found that 48% of Americans consider homosexual relations to be morally acceptable, compared with 40% in 2001. In 2006, 36% of Americans believe that homosexuality is something that you were born with, compared with only 20% in 1985. And that another stat I put down here is in 2006, 42% of Americans favored lesbians and gay men able to adopt, up from 38% in 99, and that the increase, that there's all similar increase in who favored civil unions of same-sex couples, mm-hmm. which is becoming, you know, a much more obvious battle in states for equal rights, so to speak, as marriage. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it does seem like we're moving in a direction to be more accepting of this.
No, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's a variety of different things that, you know, are probably, driving that kind of increased acceptance, right? Like we said, science, media exposure, and probably just visibility of gay parenting, too. If there are more studies and there's more acceptance, then more gay and lesbian people and parents are going to feel more comfortable being out in their communities. And so that's going to raise awareness even further. You know, you're going to be aware that your neighbor is a lesbian parent. You're going to be aware that your kid is in a class with, you know, five kids with lesbian or gay parents. So there's greater awareness, there's greater comfort in being out and in communities, and, those things just sort of feed each other.
I think, Dr. Goldberg, this is a pretty good place to kind of stop and take our typical break halfway through. And what I want to do is come back and we'll get into your book in much greater detail and talk about some of the findings specifically in your book. So let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number 550-8433. You can email at line1@alaskapublic.org. If you've got questions, we're going to take just a very short break and then rejoin our guest, Dr. Abby Goldberg. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is gay and lesbian parents and their children, and my guest is the Clark University clinical psychologist, Dr. Abby Goldberg, who has recently written a couple of books, one entitled Lesbian and Gay Parents and Their Children, and the other one is, Gay Dads Transitions to Adoptive Fatherhood. And she's joining us by telephone from Massachusetts. If you've got questions or comments, don't hesitate to give us a call, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And as you heard during the break, if you are listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a rebroadcast. If you've got questions or emails, you need to do it in the next 30 minutes or so we can address them at this time. You can always go to alaskapublic.org and find the Line 1 link and listen to this program or other programs that we've had in the past. Let's talk about lesbian and gay parents and their children in your book. What was the purpose? What were you setting out to try to do in this book, Dr. Goldberg?
So, as you kind of alluded to, it's really a kind of full-length, book-length analysis of all of the research on lesbian and gay parenting to date. So I reviewed, a couple hundred studies to sort of provide a synthesis of all of the findings on lesbian and gay parents, their parenting abilities, their mental health, their relationship quality. I also summarized the research on children and their well-being raised in these households, and it includes both kind of quantitative survey-based research and also qualitative open-ended interview-based research. And the purpose was really to kind of create a resource for people who do not read journal articles. I have now written three books, and there's those two books and then an edited book I've been involved with. And the purpose of that, of all of those, was to share, what I think is important research with a broader community of people other than just academics. So I wanted practitioners to read the book, and lesbian and gay parents, and family and friends of lesbian and gay parents, and lawyers, and researchers, and students. As again, a resource so that people aren't sort of having to look up journal articles, which aren't always the most interesting or entertaining to read in their local library.
And I think it is especially useful because you conclude each of your chapters with conclusions and recommendations. So now you have a summary of each of these broad topics, as well as a list of practical resources that people can go to, some of which we have put on our website for people to get to as well. So I think that's particularly useful for the non-academics among us.
Yep.
And I guess that was part of the thought process, is so that others could quickly get some understanding about what the science tells us at this particular time.
Right, exactly. And then in turn, as you said, the practical resources that kind of go along with that research. So knowing, for example, what kinds of resources, where to go to find out more about, as a gay parent, what do you do about schools, or what are some great videos that deal with gay parenting, or what are books that kind of delve into the topic further that are more geared towards practitioners, and so on and so forth.
So if you started on this research with kind of an unbiased view, as any good scientist should try to do, and just look at the evidence and accumulate it, is there any reason to think from the beginning that gay or lesbian parents are better or worse parents than a heterosexual parent?
Again, I think it comes back to that issue that I talked about in the very beginning of, process mattering more than family structure. So,
uh-huh.
There are good gay parents and there are bad gay parents, and there are good straight parents and there are bad straight parents. I mean, bad, mm-hmm. I'm saying bad very kind of facetiously, but what mm-hmm. I mean is there are people that are doing things that are really conducive to children's development, and that kind of, I think, cuts across every category you can possibly imagine. That being said, the empirical research finds very few differences in parenting ability as a function of sexual orientation. There are, however, some differences. So there's some interesting findings that, for example, gay men tend to look more similar to heterosexual women and lesbian women in terms of certain parenting qualities as compared to heterosexual men. So they're more nurturing on average as compared to heterosexual men. That's just an interesting mm-hmm. difference. Now, it may right. have something to do with the fact that they're parenting in the absence of another woman, and so they're sort of encouraged to sort of develop those nurturant parts of their personality or those capabilities. Mm-hmm. So there is something about structure, family structure, and parenting with another man versus another woman that might encourage different types of parenting qualities.
Mm-hmm. It would seem like gay or lesbian parents have some added burden compared to a heterosexual family, in that they're worried about whether they're going to be as good of a parent and maybe would try harder. I mean, obviously this gets into this whole issue about there's so many factors, it's hard to dissect mm-hmm. them out, but they certainly would be a minority group. I guess that's fairly safe to say. And then mm-hmm. that brings some baggage with it.
Absolutely. So at the same time that there's no sort of, you know, outstanding differences in terms of their ability to, as parents, they absolutely, as minorities, they're going to face certain struggles or certain challenges. So they may face resistance from their family, from, you know, from school, from teachers. So they're going to have more challenges in terms of educating others about their ability to be parents, helping people to get on board with their families, educating their communities, their neighbors, even becoming parents. They're probably going to encounter, as I've found, a lot more barriers, right, just in terms of, you know, dealing with potentially homophobic healthcare professionals, fertility specialists, adoption professionals, social workers, because these individuals may have certain stereotypes or certain negative ideas about them as prospective parents.
Yeah, and how they react to that may reflect on how their children see how adults react. I mean, if they look at this as a challenge and how to be educational and improve their parenting, then that is a positive thing for those, for their children and that relationship that they're in, versus those who are upset about it and try to fight it, and it may have some negative consequences both for their own relationship with their spouse and their children.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing parents can do is to be open and honest about the struggles that they're facing, but also to assure their children that, for example, the teasing that they might be encountering has absolutely nothing to do with them. It's not their problem in the sense that, there's nothing wrong with their family. There's nothing wrong with them that, you know, different people have different ideas. And unfortunately, that person or that child, you know, has some maybe, you know, some certain ideas that make it hard for them to accept them. But there's nothing wrong with that child, for example, specifically. I think that's really important to communicate.
How about the children themselves? What did you find that they have troubles with in with parents that are gay or lesbian? What were some of the challenges they had growing up?
Again, I think that sort of the biggest challenge that children might experience, again, has nothing to do really with their parents' sexual orientation per se, but much more to do with the fact that the broader society delegitimizes their families. So, for example, they sometimes encounter teasing at school. They might have to deal with peers and peers' parents and teachers who don't understand their families. When you ask children about what's challenging about being, you know, having two moms or two dads, they will say things like, you know, having to explain their families to other people, being teased about their parents' sexuality, worrying about the legal security of their own families. So, you know, the fact that their own parents' relationships can't be recognized. In some cases, their parents' legal status, their relationship to them, the children, is not recognized. So this creates a lot of worry and anxiety for children about, you know, what will happen if one of my parents passes away, or is my family really safe? Why do politicians hate my family? Those types of concerns.
Were you able to identify that there were more mental health issues in these children versus, a heterosexual home? Or, again, it's so difficult because of the multiple variables and, you know, that there's certainly significant problems in families, as you've implied already, that are heterosexual with drug and alcohol problems, or families that are not getting along in other realms.
Right. The studies are very consistent in showing that the mental health of children with lesbian and gay parents does not look very different from the children of heterosexual parents. So they do not score differently on measures of psychosocial functioning, social skills. You know, there's a few studies that suggest that they may be teased a little bit more. Other studies show that they're not. That's kind of inconclusive. One thing that seems clear is that they're more likely to be teased about their own families or but kids are teased about a wide range of things. So they may be teased the same amount, but the things they're teased about might differ, which is really important to remember because, you know, kids in elementary school tease about all kinds of things. And so they're going to find something. And then for some kids, it's just going to be their parents or their families. And for another kid, it's going to be their financial status or their weight or their intelligence or something else.
Do children maybe realize that they are in a more of a minority kind of family unit than is typical? Is that something that they pick up on very, very early? I'm going to guess as they enter the school where so much of this ostracizing or teasing or maybe even bullying is the right term comes up. Is it happen then or does it happen before then?
I think, you know, a lot of it probably will have to do with how parents handle certain things. So certainly, I think, as you mentioned, the more that children are exposed to other children, other kinds of families, right. They get to be 3, 4, 5, that's when children begin to sort of compare themselves, and they might notice differences or similarities between themselves and other kids or their own families and other kids' families. But, that's going to vary depending on, do the parents talk about it? Do they say, for example, there are all kinds of families, some families have two moms, some have two dads, or are they just silent on the issue and they kind of leave it to the child to figure that out on their own? And then as kids get older, right, 5, 6, 7, other kids are going to be picking that up and are going to be reflecting that back to a mm-hmm. child. You have two moms.
Right.
That's weird or whatever.
Uh-huh. As a clinical psychologist, how do you address that with a prospective parent, gay or lesbian parents who comes in? Do you try to tell them to begin to talk about that as early as possible and have some strategies on how to handle it?
Yeah, I think open communication and disclosure is probably the best strategy, because then you can ward off potential questions that might come later, and you can give that kid a strong foundation for how to handle questions or inquiries about their family. So the child is not in a position to run home and say, oh, my God, these kids were telling me that my family is weird. I didn't know what to say, but rather to arm that child with some information, right, to say there are all kinds of families, so that when that child is faced with those kinds of questions, they can use that language, and they have a stronger sense of kind of security about their families and how their families fits into the broader, fabric of families.
And your most recent book, Gay Dads, Transitions to Adoptive Fatherhood, you mind sharing the ideas? What led you to that one? What, there was less information, is not as much information as that needed to get out there, and be, what do we know and what do we need to get done to know more about it? Is that kind of what drove it?
Yeah, it's a study. It's a very different type of book. It's really the stories of 70 gay men who I interviewed across the transition to parenthood. So I interviewed them before and then after they became parents through adoption. And so the purpose of it was really to kind of paint a much more a real life portrait of what it's like to be a gay couple, gay man, and to adopt, and all the ways that your life changes and all the sort of different challenges and joys that one faces. And so it was sort of meant to be more illustrative as opposed to sort of all-encompassing, which the first book was aimed to be. And it was really a response to the fact that there's almost no research on gay male adoptive parents. It was definitely aimed to address that particular gap, but also to be sort of more of a mainstream type of book, so a book that a gay dad or a gay man considering parenthood might pick up, or even just somebody who's interested in issues of adoption or family more generally.
And you said there were some suggested findings that gay men as parents are more like, I'm trying to remember what you said earlier, lesbian parents in their parenting style or their the way they do things, or am I misrepresenting it? What did you find with these guys?
Oh, just that as a whole, I did a different sort of analysis that showed that gay men are, and this is something that's been in other research, that they're a bit more perhaps nurturant as parents as compared to heterosexual fathers. And that
may
be
okay.
The fact that they're two men, that there's no woman.
Right.
Sort of,
right.
They have to kind of develop all of their various potential parenting capacities. So.
Yeah. So they're making a special effort to try to compensate for the fact that they're two men, and And that doesn't necessarily happen when there are two women that are parenting to the same degree.
I mean, I get compensate might be one word. Another word just might be that they're more sort of, they feel more free or more encouraged to develop that aspect of themselves. I also found that these men consider themselves to be more skilled at parenting than heterosexual men. Again, I think that has a lot to do with the fact that they share childcare more equally. So you see yourself as more nurturing. You see yourself as more skilled as a parent when you're changing more diapers and you're spending more time with your kid and you're feeding your kid more. So if heterosexual men did fewer of those activities, so they didn't feel as skilled, right? So one informs the other. So I think part of it is just they were sharing more, as opposed to in heterosexual couples where the woman is doing more.
Have you found or heard from, you know, policymakers and the legal system in particular that the information that you have been able to cull together and analyze has been helpful in changing, attitudes and policy and legal proceedings? You've mentioned some of the legal proceedings. I'm always interested in policy as well.
You're sort of asking about what are the implications,
right?
And
what have you heard back from individuals or aware of changes that might have occurred due to the making this kind of information more available to people?
Yeah, I mean, I think both books, particularly the first one, because it is a synthesis of all the research. It's been out longer. I've heard from numerous legal organizations and lawyers who have used the book in various court cases pertaining to gay adoption, marriage equality, and other sorts of, custody cases, where they can use it as a kind of one-stop shopping type of resource. So as opposed to having to read themselves all of those hundreds of studies, they can sort of rely on the book as a fairly an accurate and fairly representative body of knowledge that they can sort of use in a courtroom. So I have heard of many cases where that has, or many instances of where that is the case, which is great.
Yeah. And I'm sure that was part of your hope, is that by providing in an easy format all the information that, or kind of collating that information and making it more easily available would help advance more humane, I don't know what the right, more educated point of views about how we look at gay and lesbians and other people with somewhat different sexual identifications. I guess one of the big questions a lot of people who are listening may have is the issue about the sexual gender identity issues of the children of gay and lesbian parents. What can you tell us that you found in this area?
So in terms of children's sexual identity, the research is pretty consistent in showing that children are no more likely to identify as exclusively gay or lesbian. A few studies have found that they may be more open to same-sex relationships or experiences. So that shouldn't be that shocking to people, because, of course, if you consider your parents to be, normal and good parents, the whole issue of homosexuality is destigmatized. So they're less sort of disgusted, you could say, by the idea of homosexuality. So they're less likely to say, oh my gosh, I could never imagine that. So they're more likely to say, I consider myself heterosexual, but I'm not going to rule anything out. So that's essentially the finding, which really does make sense. And again, shouldn't come as any shocking surprise. It does not have any implications for gender identity, so children with lesbian and gay parents are no more likely to feel that they are, that their gender identity is different from the sex that they were born.
Mm-hmm. And you've already implied or said also the psychological health of these children do not differ dramatically from other families.
Right, exactly. Mental health, safe self-esteem, social functioning, really no differences in any of those areas.
What about this, where the children are coming from? And I ask that in the sense of thinking about genetics versus, you know, nature, nurture, in the sense that both the gay men may have had children from a marriage or a female partner, and vice versa for lesbians. So there's some genetic components. And then in other families, these kids are adopted and not having any genetic biological relationship to their parents. Is there anything there that you find interesting or intriguing to help us understand some of these issues?
I mean, we really don't have any studies that compare children across those different family formation types. So there is no research that compares, say, children who are raised, you know, by, you know, who were adopted by lesbian and gay parents with children who were born in the context of heterosexual relationship and then raised by lesbian, you know, and then children who were born, you know, by insemination to a lesbian couple. We just don't have studies that compare to kind of estimate the degree of genetic contribution to sexual orientation. So I don't think we can say much about that. I think, you know, we know from other research that sexual orientation appears to have a biological basis, but again, that is not to say that social context and experiences are not relevant at all. And I think the findings related to gay parenting probably support that. So I don't think there's anything, I don't think that we can say there's anything new that we've learned, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, straight heterosexual people have gay children, and gay children have straight kids. So I think we can't say that there's a direct line from one to the other.
And I know from asking you about that before we came on the air that this is not an area of your expertise, and you don't want to spend a lot of time acting like you're an expert on how gender or sexual identity and general identity come about. But it's been my understanding, and again, you can say you don't want to comment anymore, that perhaps we really don't have a good understanding of that as well, and that there's a kind of almost like a bell-shaped curve among females and males about their attraction or their interest in same-sex or heterosexual. So it's not an all-or-none phenomenon. I mean, are we safe enough now being able to say that, or you're still not so sure we even have to able to say that that's true and that this bell-shaped curve or this variability in attraction to other members of the same sex is maybe more of the norm than we think?
Well, I think it's definitely safe to say that there's a lot of variability. I also think it's important to emphasize that we've seen changes, you know, in over the last 10 to 15, 20 years, so really cohort effects in terms of how people identify in terms of their sexual orientation. So young people today are more likely to espouse a much more fluid sexual orientation, to say that they are bisexual or more open or mostly heterosexual or mostly gay. So they're less likely to want to pin themselves into these all-or-nothing categories. There are fewer and fewer people who want to say, I'm 100% heterosexual, I'm 100% gay. You see more in the middle. And I think that has to do with a willingness to kind of be, you know, to sort of be more flexible because it is more acceptable.
And again, I'm kind of, you know, getting a little bit off task here, but I kind of want to take advantage of the topic and your expertise. Is when we're as parents addressing children who may express some differences in their interest in the same sex than their parents may like, how would you counsel those parents in addressing those issues?
In terms of just having a child who's expressing attractions or interests.
Right.
I mean, it's funny. I, you know, there's been a lot written about that. Again, it's sort of the reverse of what my research really focuses on. But I mean, I think that there's actually a really increasing community of parents who are talking about this, particularly on the internet, and getting support for each other in dealing with that. I guess my advice would just be to listen to your child and also not make any, you know, jump to any conclusions. A child who, for example, a boy who says, I want to marry my best friend who's a boy, or I like to dress up in fairy princess outfits, that boy is not necessarily gay.
Right.
So it's important not to confuse sort of normal developmental, you know, interests, and we have to remember that it's just, we have to just learn who our children are over time. And if they're gay, hopefully that will be fine. And you'll support your child no matter what. Understanding that parents who stigmatize their child's emerging non-heterosexuality, that has really, we know from research, much more profoundly negative effects on children than supporting them, which may seem really obvious, but I think that parents may struggle and they need to really get support for themselves if they're struggling because their child is, you know, coming out as gay, recognizing that it's children who have their parents' support do so much better in terms of their own mental health, their own self-esteem, their social support. They're much less likely to self-harm. You know, parents play a huge role in that regard.
I did get an email here, and we've just got a couple of minutes left, but I think it's worth reading and let's get your opinion. This is from a woman. She says, I'm a parent who is raising two teens with my partner. I'm looking for support groups and so on for partners who are entering as a parent role but with kids who are older. My partner is their biological mother. Our girls are accepting of our relationship, and I'm needing support as a step-parent. Please help me know where to go for support as a parent.
It's a great, great question. And I think despite what people often think that most gay parent households are made up of people who had the children in the context of that relationship, and that's actually not true. The majority are the situation that she's describing, you know, people who had children in the context of a heterosexual relationship perhaps and then formed a lesbian or gay step-parent family. In terms of specific support groups for gay or lesbian step-parents, I don't know if there's a ton out there. Like, I think it really varies on based on geography. But there are some good, I know that there's some great sort of more academic books. Minion Moore is a researcher, a sociologist, who's done research specifically on black lesbian stepfamilies, and a lot of what she addresses in her work is relevant to lesbian stepfamilies as a whole in terms of the kind of dynamics that come up in those families. So, again, hers is more academic, but she does have a book out called Invisible Families, which could be a great resource.
I've got a website that we've linked to called proudparenting.com, which talks about it, provides information for adoption, foster care, and parenting support for lesbian, gay parents. So there are some websites on or some links on our website as well as in your book that might be helpful as too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, thanks very much. I was hoping we'd encourage a few more callers and get the discussion going a little bit broader, not just my ideas and thoughts and questions, but I very much appreciate your taking the time to write the book and provide all this, collating all that information about this problem. It's been wonderful to have a chance to talk to you about it.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. You have a good afternoon, and thanks again. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. So my thanks to Dr. Abby Goldberg, and let me remind listeners, if you want to continue with this kind of topic, you can go to KSKA and join us on Facebook. You can find the link on our website, alaskapublic.org. About a quarter of us all suffer from anxiety disorders at one time or another. Next week, we're going to be discussing this group of problems and what is available for solutions with Anne-Marie Zach, who is a nurse practitioner practicing in psychiatric problems, and Prentice Pemberton, who's a licensed clinical social worker. So why not tune into your health and learn more about anxiety Monday, December 10th from 2 to 3 p.m. As usual, we'll repeat the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and our audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.